Welcome to the podcast, Positively Geared. My name is Alex Augustiniak, and our next topic, Money, 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 will be a two-part series due to the extent of the content we need to cover off on. In part one, we welcome Jerome, part of Lloyd's Dream Team, and mortgage broker. G'day, Lloyd.
Hey, Alex, how's things?
Very well. How are you?
Yeah, I'm doing well, thanks.
Very good. Episode Money, 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 part one of two. We have a special guest on the show today, Jerome Balagtas, partner and mortgage broker at One Solutions. Welcome, Jerome.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me.
So, Jerome, what really resonated with me before we went on the air, just in conversation with you, was that you're obviously a broker, but you're also a property investor yourself. So you've sort of experienced both sides of the transaction, if you like.
Yeah, that's right, Alex. I've been in finance for the last 20 years. And over the years, I've bought investments. And throughout that period, I've worked out strategies. And I've basically been able to tie that up with my mortgage industry. And I've been able to pass that knowledge onto my clients to help them progress as well. So I think the skill sets I have in the experience I've had in investing in properties and at the same time having the mortgage broking industry allows me to help my clients pretty well and give them that advice so that they can actually build wealth through properties.
One of the core concepts that Lloyd and I have discussed across our podcast series is really the importance of having a great strategy behind everything you do when building a property portfolio or investing, whether it's your first or your 10th property. What is the importance of a broker?
Well, Alex, the importance of a broker is the broker can facilitate for the client's needs. Traditionally, clients go directly to a bank and seek each bank's policies and interest rates. A broker is there to actually facilitate on the client's needs by understanding what they want to do, what they need to borrow, and where they would fit best with depending on which of the banks that broker sees fit that they would be best going to apply for.
Excellent. And Lloyd, you guys do a lot of work together, don't you?
Absolutely, for sure.
How long have you guys been working for?
We've probably been working together for about 5 or 6 years now. Jerome actually first came to me. He's actually a client and he actually went through the process of building a duplex with me. And then from there, we started working together where he was referring a few of his clients to me, and then I was finding property solutions for them. He was doing the finance for them. And we had some good work done together there. But what I really liked about Jerome was just the honesty and the trustworthiness that he brings to the solution. I find that it's hard to find people that you can trust in this industry, in the real estate industry in general. And I think getting back to that question, what you were asking Jerome before about, what does a broker bring to the table? Well, one thing I think I might just bring Jerome back in here is, I guess when people go to a bank, they're just getting offered one solution. I believe that when you use a broker might have up to perhaps 30 different lenders. Jerome, can you maybe give us a little bit more information on that?
Yeah, that's right. Like we've got 30 different lenders or even more. And as I said, it just depends on the client's circumstances where if they've got limited lending capacity, we've got to try and find the right bank that can actually maximize their lending. We get a lot of clients where they want to actually borrow. Today's tough lending restriction requirements, what's happened is that it's been difficult to actually access funds, and that's why lending and properties have actually decreased in values in the last few years, because Royal Commission has actually kind of slowed that up in the last few years. And as a result, lending has become very rigid and difficult to access funds. So we've now got to actually understand the various banks' policies and calculation loopholes to actually be able to deliver that lending requirement that the client needs to be able to purchase or do that investment. A lot of times that clients are limited with borrowing capacity, which limits them to a certain investment class. And And if you've got a successful broker that can understand the client's needs, they can actually access more funds, and that client is actually able to look at a better investment class or a better area, which would potentially be a better return on growth eventually.
Yeah, I think the other thing that I find a lot of clients struggle with is their serviceability. So they might come having tried to go through a major lender like Commonwealth Bank or NAB, and then a broker can actually find a solution through a non-bank lender, you know, such as Pepper or Liberty. I even use Liberty Liberty and La Trobe and even Pepper. I think I've got about three loans myself with Pepper, which have been set up by brokers, and I think they're really good for serviceability for people that are maybe running out of serviceability when they're either got a lower income or they've got a lot of properties and things. And I think that's something that a broker can really help with too.
Yeah, that's right. Look, I mean, serviceability requirements has definitely changed in the last few years, and it's looking at the client's overall picture. And I'll give you an example. There's times that I've actually gone through the client's budget, and we've tried to understand where they're spending too much, where can they actually cut back? Because sometimes when we can cut back on things, we can actually get that through. We can actually increase the borrowing capacity. It's an example of negotiating discounts on electricity bills, right? Not a lot of people understand that they can get a 22, 23% discount with an energy company. And when you do the budget, because we've got to actually understand their budget and their monthly expenses, that actually makes an impact in borrowing capacity, as an example.
Before we went on the air, Jerome, you know, we spoke about, we just touched on briefly in conversation, you know, what should people be looking for in a broker? And, you know, you mentioned the importance of a broker that has a holistic approach to finance. And you've just sort of briefly touched on that in terms of really digging deep into people's spending habits and I suppose helping them possibly unlock more borrowing capacity than they initially thought. Is there any other good points that you find have been giving you great success recently?
Look, I find that starting off with a budget with the customers to allow them to understand their spending habits and their cash flow allows them to understand what they've done with their funds, and it allows them to actually also realize that they've got to set goals. A lot of people have that vision that they want to invest, they want to build wealth, but they haven't really put down in paper vision and goals. Without vision and goals, you don't have direction. And when I look at a client comes to me and they look at me as I'm going to help them with lending. I actually look at it as if I'm going to help them in an overall situation. And when I do the whole job where we start the budget, then we realize cash flow, then we start to set budget short-term, long-term, what we want to do with regards to the investment, what they want to achieve from the investment, whether it's a short-term, long-term, or whether it's going to be a set and forget or a strategy where we're manufacturing. It just really depends. And a good broker I see actually tries to understand the client and will journey with that client, because brokers get paid trail. And it's in our interest to look after our clients. And every few years, I call my client and say, hey, look, you know, your rates, they're probably too high. We better speak to the bank and negotiate that down. If that bank doesn't negotiate it, bring it down to an acceptable price, then we can look at other banks, right? In general, that's what a broker normally does, but a good broker would actually go beyond that and say, hey, look, you know, it's been a few years. Let's get your property valued. Let's see what capital growth and equity you have now, and let's see what else we could do with that equity and see if we could continue to build wealth.
So, Jerome, yeah, that's as you know, with our business, we really try to look at the long-term goals of our clients, what they're trying to achieve over the next 5, 10, 15 years, and formulate a property strategy around that. I was wondering if you could tell our listeners how the financial strategy would fit in with that. I think a lot of brokers and even banks will perhaps just try to get one transaction over the line, but how do you look at a finance strategy so that 2, 3, 4 properties down the line, they're still able to obtain finance?
Yeah, good question, Lloyd. As you said, a lot of the bankers would probably look at the single transaction, but when we actually sit down with a client, what I'm trying to do is I'm actually trying to understand what their objectives are in the short term and medium term and long term. And then what I try and do is I'd actually model their borrowing capacity. If we already have an investment at hand on the first transaction, I'd calculate the borrowing capacity and then forecast the equity that we can achieve within a medium to medium term time frame, and then I try and see if whether they can borrow to buy another second property after that. Okay, a lot of times people aren't forecasting that, and a lot of times that's what actually happens. People don't buy a property more than two or three properties after that because they haven't planned ahead. So a lot of times we're actually looking at the client's investment strategy as well, because a lot of times people are buying properties that are negatively geared, all right? And the problem with buying a negative geared property is that this may work for a high-income earner in terms of reducing the tax, but at the same time, it's not allowing them to continually build their portfolio, because most people would probably only be only to buy two or three properties and then cap out in borrowing capacity.
So Lloyd, you and Jerome have worked quite closely over the past 5 or so years. What are there any examples of a time where you've either had a client or personally where you've found the synergy between mortgage broker and your services and experience have really helped benefit a client?
There's been several occasions actually with where mortgage brokers have come in very handy. Jerome and I've worked very closely with a lot of people. But yeah, look, one that really comes to mind is a gentleman called Ronell, who's actually a doctor, who actually built a duplex in the Newcastle region, actually, just outside Newcastle, where he obtained well over $200,000 in equity from that. That actually allowed him to move into another purchase where they actually used the equity to move into another duplex project, and now they're actually looking at doing a third third project there. I'll let Jerome talk a little bit more about the situation that they're in and what they're actually looking for the long term.
Yeah, look, Ronell and his wife, they're very hesitant to invest. I mean, they've got their own property and they were more focused on trying to pay off their debt. But for a few years, I actually encouraged them to buy an investment and invest to build wealth. A lot of the reluctance was around cash flow. A lot of people are worried about cash flow to buy an investment property. And the strategy that we had that Lloyd had implemented was that we could buy a property or buy a piece of land, build a duplex on it, mitigate the risk, which is cash flow risk. When this property was built, well, this duplex was built, it was actually positively geared. So it's looking after itself. So as we were able to explain that to the client from day one. And that's the reason why that client was a bit more happy to actually jump in and actually invest, because otherwise I don't think that they would have invested. So in this case here, we were able to mitigate that risk, but at the same time show them that there is a strategy to actually manufacture growth instead of just buying a property and hoping for the best.
Jerome, you mentioned just with that case study about that client, one of their biggest fear points was just taking on more debt. Obviously, at the time, they were very much honed in on reducing the current debt they had. How did you find that the synergy that you and Lloyd had enabled you guys to sort of get that commitment from them to take that leap of faith and take on more debt?
I think it's more about understanding the client and understanding what they really want to achieve and their objectives. In their case, what they wanted to really achieve is have their be able to pay off their home loan. They had a conventional way of understanding that if I pay my mortgage as fast as I can, they'll be debt-free, which, of course, that works. But we actually explained to the client that there's other ways of actually being able to actually pay off debt even much faster. And at the same time, we also had to understand what was the main hindrance of them investing. And as I said earlier, the main hindrance was the cash flow risk. They didn't want to have to fork out anymore on a monthly basis. So we were able to come up with a solution where, number one, the property would be positively geared, okay, and number two, the property would make money from day one. Once we actually explained that to the client, we were able to eliminate those two concerns that they had, that they didn't want to have to fork out something every month and they didn't want to buy a bad investment because it wasn't going to make any money.
That's a really good example, I think, Jerome, of where obviously your services have helped transfer some belief into the client, but you've also addressed their concerns and allowed them to move forward in addition to what Lloyd's advice, which is a big win, I think, and it's a great example of how the two of you are obviously working really successfully together. sort of moving forward onto, I suppose, some of the, if we look at finance at more of a face value or a surface level, if you like, just wanting to debunk some of the myths that I think hold a lot of people back from making that initial first steps, which is really the, you know, forming that first building block of building a portfolio or you know, going down the avenue of achieving financial freedom or whatever their goal may be. Some of those common topics are concepts like paying LMI, understanding loan to value ratios. So is it essential to have a 20% deposit? Talk us through your experiences in that space and maybe possibly a couple examples of when you've had to sort of pull clients back and say, well, you know what, based on what you're trying to achieve, you know, it is okay to absorb a lender's mortgage insurance, or it is okay to purchase without a 20% deposit.
Yeah, look, lending mortgage insurance is a common thing. A lot of people don't want to pay it, but I think people just need to understand how it can work in their favor and what they want to achieve as an investor. By paying mortgage insurance, it means that you're allowed to borrow to the maximum of 90% against your current property. And what that means is basically you've got more money or more deposit to be able to buy an investment property. All right. That's what you call leveraging, using the bank's money. When you use the bank's money, you can actually buy an investment. The analogy I like to use is basically you've got a house ready. All right. That's your owner-occupied house, right? What you want to do is you want to buy another house. That house to me is there are two buckets. And those buckets, they collect water or they collect money, right? What would you rather have, one bucket or two buckets? Most people always answer, I want two buckets. And that's what leveraging is. Like you're borrowing money so you can buy yourself another bucket and collect more money. And that's the best analogy I've used that works well with clients.
Sure. And for people that possibly are looking to break into the market, so they're very much in the infancy of becoming an investor, yeah. You know, they've obviously identified that they want to invest in property, they want to build a portfolio. And you know, one of the key topics that Lloyd covers off in his book is when he started out with only $40,000. What does that advice change at all when you're talking to somebody that's about to make their first purchase and they're trying to break into the market?
One common question is, when's the best time? The answer there is always, the best time is when you can buy. And if you've only got a small deposit, but you can buy something with a strategy, then pay the mortgage insurance. A lot of people do want to wait until they've got a bigger deposit. The problem with waiting until they've saved a bigger deposit is the market may shift and change and increase. I've seen it a lot. A lot of people do just say, oh, look, I'll sit back. I'm just going to save another 5% or 10% and then I'll buy. But what they don't realize is the market's changed by 10 to 20 points.
Exactly. I think that's a really good point. I mean, we look at the last property cycle and, you know, 2013-14, it was really starting to get some forward momentum. And then all of a sudden by 2017, you know, some suburbs, depending on your region, had achieved double-digit growth within a short period of time. So, you know, I think for a lot of people that was sort of trying to build up that deposit, the market's then moved another 150, 200,000, for example, if you're in an area with sort of, you know, an average sale price at the time of $1 million, and that sort of gone really against what they were trying to achieve in the first place.
Mm, that's right.
Lloyd, is there any light that you'd like to shed on these topics in terms of your experience?
I really love what Jerome was saying about the two buckets. I always think of, if you've got enough deposit to buy a property for 20% deposit, then I always think, well, why not buy two properties at 10% each, basically, because it's leveraging. You've got two, you know, you buy two properties and then you can turn those into four properties and things like that. So I think that's really important. I grew my portfolio really using lenders mortgage insurance. So I don't want people to be scared of paying that, because, you know, people do think, oh, it's a, you know, it's a waste of money and things, but really if it helps you get ahead, then I think that's really important. And I use that many times as I was growing my portfolio. So something very important.
I think that's key, because a lot of people do also borrow within mortgage insurance space, but they overdo it. They buy two, three or four properties on mortgage insurance, but what they don't think about is cash flow. So you've also got to have a strategy around borrowing within mortgage insurance, because you don't want to overextend yourself. There have been a lot of people where they've borrowed, you know, 90 plus, and there's just the cash flow requirement on a monthly basis. It's just been too much.
Yeah, totally agree. And it all comes back to, yeah, everything's about strategy. So in my book and through this podcast series, we're going to be talking about property strategy, but this is related to finance strategy. And you just need to have a plan with everything you do. So yeah, I totally agree with that. So it's all about how everything fits in with each other, how each property fits in with the next property you're going to buy, and how the finance is going to work for that and everything.
Jerome, in your experience, when you're, let's look at clients that are possibly, you know, they've scraped the surface, they're on their second or third property. How do you find the conversation often changes with those people in terms of, are they often meeting a roadblock in terms of being able to then borrow again? Is it heavily dependent on their disposable income? What are some of the drivers that sort of affect people and influence their capacity to continue to push forward with a portfolio?
Yeah, it's quite common because, you know, there are a lot of people there that have one or two or three investment properties already. But the common thing I see is that they've bought properties without too much thought or consideration. And cash flow is an issue. At the same time, borrowing capacity is an issue. A lot of them are negatively geared, as I said earlier. When you borrow a negatively geared property, that means that you've got to fork out more money every month just to have that property. What happens is that they can't borrow as much anymore, all right? So I actually have a lot of conversations for clients where we actually now have to work out which properties or which investment properties they actually have and which are going to perform and which we may have to just let go so that we can continue to roll the dice and continue investing to build a portfolio.
It's a really good point, Lloyd. I know we've touched on briefly in our first two episodes and we'll continue to discuss this over the course of the series, the importance of having, you know, a strong mix of properties that are obviously cash flow positive, but also depending on the circumstance, some negatively geared. Just having that cash flow positive segment of a portfolio really does allow you to sort of continue to push forward, doesn't it?
Absolutely, yeah, and that's the way really to grow a portfolio, as Joan would, you know, I'm sure he would agree with. Because if you're negatively gearing your portfolio, everything's cash flow negative, then there's a limit to how many, you know, properties the banks are going to lend you and everything. But if you got cash flow happening there, then you'll be able to get ahead quicker. And you know, we've talked about a little bit of negative gearing, but that's only basically if you're buying, you know, high growth blue chip properties, and basically anything that's negatively geared eventually will become positively geared anyway.
There's other things to consider as well, you know, structuring a loan and how you purchase that property. You know, there's tools such as trust or family trust. You know, there's considerations around how to actually maximize or minimize your tax. Using those vehicles. A lot of times people don't consider this. And, you know, another example is also land tax. You know, there's you've got to navigate around that, you know, in ownership and who owns that property and understanding those thresholds so you can actually pay less land tax.
Yeah, I recommend clients buy in different states for land tax, looking at what the thresholds are, but then also the different structures as well. Yeah, because, but you know, obviously getting the proper advice from, you know, from their accountant and financial advisors, because you're buying in different entities, then that has different tax implications, whether you're buying in a, you know, in a trust structure or individual names and everything like that.
Open question. So Jerome or Lloyd, whoever feels I'd like to cover off on the topic, how important, is there a golden rule when you guys are in the living room speaking to people that are at sort of the crossroads to make that next purchasing decision, or possibly having to offload a property to build a portfolio? Is there a golden rule towards having a mix within a portfolio of cash flow positive versus negatively geared properties? And the reason I ask is I think there's always been a lot of commentary in the general public that, you know, negative gearing is the way to go. And that's, as we've clearly identified, not necessarily the case whatsoever.
I'll just jump in here first, I guess. But it really comes down to strategy, what you're trying to achieve. Some people on high incomes will want to negatively gear a property for tax. That's actually not a strategy. It's definitely not a property strategy. It's an outcome if you can get a good tax refund based on that. But really, you really need to look at what your long-term goals are. You also need to look at where you are in terms of your own finances and your own income, because sometimes you need a positive cash flow property, or at least something that's neutrally geared for the banks to even lend you. And you know, being able to move forward, particularly to the next property. But looking at those long-term goals, you know, 10 years down the track, the reason why we look at you know, the instant equity you can get, the cash flow and the capital growth is, you know, what are your long-term goals and how are we going to get there? How is that equity going to help you get there? And also that exit strategy at the end. So the reason why we might have some negatively geared properties in a portfolio, and I've got some as well, is simply because of where they're strategically located. They might be properties that I'm holding, you know, for the long term. The most recent property I bought was only a few weeks ago, which I actually bought for my my son, who's only 10 months old at the moment. And so that's currently it's actually positively geared only because I put down quite a big deposit on it. But theoretically, it's a negatively geared property because of the location, blue chip property in Sydney. But that'll eventually become positively geared. But it's also a really high growth property. But when I buy properties like that, I always balance it out by doing the dual income properties, the duplexes that are located in areas that will get me really good cash flow as well.
I think it's cash flow is quite important. If I had to answer that, cash flow would always be good to assist and be able to continue to invest. But I've got a client at the moment. He's got like 7-8 properties, but a lot of his loans are dropping off interest only. So that means his cash flow is going to be heavily impacted, and he's worried about that. He's actually purchased properties at 90, and the fact is that it's going to be a struggle to actually get these loans refinanced or restructured to an interest-only facility again.
If he's if his loans are dropping off to be P&I, are you able to refinance them, or is that not an option at the moment?
And that's my point. It might be difficult to actually refinance it given the different lending requirements these days. So what we're actually doing now is I'm actually doing various calculations and modeling just to try and see which properties we're going to have to let go so he can keep some of the other properties and then have enough to actually invest with a strategy. And this time around, maybe invest with high cash flow properties so that he's not going to have this problem in future as well.
Yeah, so it all comes back to strategy.
Correct.
I remember a couple of years ago, I had a couple of loans with ANZ. I've still got them, but they dropped off interest only to P&I, and ANZ won't let me go with interest only anymore, so I'm just paying interest on them, which is okay, but it does, you got to really look at what you're trying to achieve, because that means that my loan repayments are higher on that as well. So you need to look at your overall position and whether that satisfies and whether you can cope with that and everything.
I think this conversation is a great segue into our next topic or conversation within finance and brokerage. When somebody is building a portfolio, let's talk about, for the layman, interest only versus principal and interest on residential loans. What is there typically a pattern that you like to follow in terms of recommending the right product to somebody?
I think it depends on the risk appetite. That's one. The other thing is it just depends on the objective. Like if a client wants to continue to buy as much investment properties, interest only could work because from a cash flow point of view, that will assist them, right? However, from a borrowing point of view, an interest-only facility actually has less borrowing capacity these days.
Sure. We have observed too, obviously we're recording in Sydney, and, over the past few years, the Royal Commission on Banking did really affect the availability of credit. Predominantly in 2018, it was very hard for people to get access to credit. We're also now finding that a lot of people around 2015, 14, that had financed properties with interest-only loans, as you mentioned, they're all starting to get called in now, and refinancing will be very difficult for them. And I can tell by the look on your face, Rowan, that you're in full agreement. So what are some of the strategies and outcomes? I know you briefly touched on you're looking at sort of other options for them, but in terms of ensuring that a portfolio is always constantly moving forward and growing, how do you generally deal with that if in the event that the worst case happens? Because I'm sure there are people listening today that might be in that similar position where they're sort of at the crossroads and need to make some decisions fast.
Yeah, I'm definitely seeing that. I mean, as that example I gave earlier, a lot of people think they got to sell, but it's not the best time to sell in given the current marketing climate. So looking for good alternatives is actually the best way. There are banks there, well, non-banks or specialized banks that are tending to lend a bit more than main banks. An example, some of these banks, when they're calculating existing debt that you already have, they'd use actual repayments plus a small buffer, okay? Whereas an actual, like CBA or Westpac, if you've already got a debt, they would actually use the actual repayment plus a sensitized or 2.5% buffer, roughly, okay? Which means that they can't borrow as much, okay? But if we look at those specialized banks that are just using actual repayments, or actual repayments plus a small margin, they can actually try and refinance it to those banks. Also looking at the client's overall position. Sometimes they've just got too much credit cards. They've got personal debts that we can consolidate. And there's a lot of things that you can look at just beyond the actual home loan lending before they start to look at selling that investment property.
In terms of other products within, I suppose, your space and how you're working with clients, is there a general rule of thumb? I mean, some advice that I was given many years ago is that you should always pay the principal down on your primary residence, but then there's no real necessity to finance beyond that, pay principal on an investment property that you never intend to hold. Do you think that's good advice, or is it, you know, very much driven once again by strategy?
It is driven by strategy. As an investor, I think it's great advice. Say your objective is to pay down your owner-occupied debt. You don't want to pay off your investment debt while you still have an owner-occupied debt. The reason why is the investment debt is a tax deductible expense, or at least the interest cost against that is a tax deductible expense. If you're paying principal and interest on that, then what would happen is every month you're reducing that loan balance, and as a result, your interest cost is reducing. So less interest cost to claim against investment property means eventually that property may eventually be positively geared, or even more positively geared if it's already positively geared. So you're paying tax.
Thanks for that answer, Jerome. So Lloyd, what's your position on, and I want you to really draw on your own experience building your portfolio, and obviously further to that, any clients that you've helped, you know, that you're helping build their wealth. Do you have an overall position on how to structure your portfolio in terms of P&I versus interest only?
Look, I totally agree with what Jerome was saying in terms of the fact that you really need to pay down that your principal place of residence. That's where your money should be going, because it's non-tax deductible there. So the rest of it, look, I grew my portfolio with always the belief that, yeah, you should only be doing interest only on that. I think my view has changed a little bit in more recent years as I start to consolidate and I start to pinpoint the properties that I might look at keeping, and therefore there's some that come off that interest only onto P&I, and I think, okay, well, I might be keeping these properties for the long term, so I'm happy to start paying them down. So from an overall portfolio, it really just depends on the actual property, where they are in my portfolio. The other thing that drives a little bit, as I mentioned a little bit before, is what the banks are looking at. So from my perspective, a couple of lenders have sort of changed their policy a bit, and they won't allow interest only loan, it's P&I, well, at least under my circumstances. Things have changed a bit, over the years. Years ago I used to be a teacher, I was on PAYG. These days I'm a business owner. When banks look at my income for serviceability, it's very complicated, because they're looking at my portfolio of about 16 properties. They're also looking at my business income. They're looking at the salaries that I pay my staff. So everything's very complicated. Some banks, serviceability calculator is a little bit different. Some banks allow something, other banks don't allow, things like that. So that can have, slight effects as well. In terms of advising clients, I'm still a big advocate for, paying interest only, because that's what you can, that's fully tax deductible on your investment properties. But once we get to that exit strategy and start planning that, then that kind of changes it a little bit as well. So, for me, there's three stages in investment strategy, really. It's the, you got your acquisition phase, and then your hold phase, and then the third stage of the exit strategy. When we're talking about that exit strategy is when we might start changing the finance around some of that. So that's very much done in a case-by-case scenario. But like I said, sometimes it's driven by the banks. APRA has changed things in recent years. Banks lending is becoming a little bit tighter. So there's a few things around that. They're a little bit different to when I started building my portfolio 18 or so years ago.
Jerome, back to the space that you're working in, and of everyone sitting in this room right now, you're the one that's probably having the most conversations with people when it comes to the nitty gritty and getting finance. Do you have any advice for people that aren't PAYG, that are possibly self-employed? I suppose, like Lloyd, access to funds might be possibly more difficult. I'm talking about industries where, income might, or revenue might fluctuate over different periods of time. Is there any different approach that you take with them, or that any good advice for people that are listening that are sort of in that space at the moment?
I think forward planning is very important for self-employed. it's their accountant's objective to minimize tax. But if they have plans to borrow funds to build wealth and buy properties or anything about anything related to borrowing money, I think it's key that they speak to that broker or to their broker and allow introduce that broker to their accountant. And that way that accountant and that broker can already forecast what needs to be reported in their tax returns. People do it on a quarterly basis if they're doing BAS, or some do it on a yearly basis. But if a broker and accountant are already talking about the client's circumstances and what the client wants to achieve, then what you'll find is that these self-employed people will be able to access that funds a bit more easier with the banks, because the accountant knows, okay, well, I don't want to wind down their income to get the client to pay too much tax.
Jerome, what are some other products? We've discussed, Lloyd's touched on, you know, he's done a few duplex style projects. There's obviously things like construction loans. What's your experience with those and how do they differ to, you know, your sort of more standard finance?
Yeah, construction loans are usually a bit more harder to understand for clients because it's a bit more involved. In most cases, it's a split contract where the client needs to purchase a vacant block of land. So funding is needed there. And then there's a second stage, which is called the progress funding or the construction loan. Construction loans usually paid up on stages, 5 to 6 stages. And depending on when the builder is ready to lay out the slab, an invoice gets called, and then the frames and so forth, a bank gradually pays that that loan to the builder, and the client's loan gets bigger and bigger each time. Okay, a lot of times what I've seen is that clients have gone to the wrong bank, because some banks actually restrict lending for construction loans. Some banks actually have a higher interest rate for construction loans. Some banks will only do maximum 70%, as an example, on construction loans. Some banks will only do 80% on interest only on construction loans. It just depends on what the client wants to achieve. And if the client actually tries to wing it and go to the bank themselves, they may find that they may not be able to achieve what they want to try and do if they're working with Lloyd and trying to build buy land and build a duplex, in this example.
So, Jerome, for people that are looking at a construction loan, what's important for them to assess? Let's say, for example, they're looking to purchase a vacant plot of land. You know, a lot of people might not factor in that it's not income producing at that point in time, and there's also no improved value on the lot. Therefore, does that make it harder to obtain finance? Does it alter the parameters required for you to get finance for those people? How do you sort of deal with that?
Yeah, it's important to forecast whether they can borrow the required amount to complete the land purchase. When you purchase land, there's no income on that. A lot of times that's missed. If you actually present the transaction, if it's a split contract where you're trying to buy the land and doing a construction loan at the same time and you've got the building tenders, you're better off lodging that to the bank together at the same time and doing it as one application, because it will be assessed as one application and get approved as one application. If you actually lodge it in two different applications, a land and a construction, the land will settle. But if it takes time for the builders to sort out everything with council and their approval for that construction loan expires, you run the risk of actually having to get reapproved. So it's quite quite common that that a lot of people have to get reapproved. But the trick there is just try and lodge it all in one go and you won't have that problem.
Sure. Lloyd, what's your experience? Did you have to go down that avenue when you were investing for somebody or constructing yourself?
Absolutely. So you really need to always get a construction loan through together. The worst thing you can do is really just get the land by itself and then worry about the build contract later.
Yeah.
It does present all sorts of problems. You really want the construction loan to settle as a construction loan, because if you just have the land settle, then you got this build contract that doesn't actually settle until they have the slab come down and the first progress payment comes in. Then that can present a problem, because you never know how long council's going to take for an approval. So it puts the clients at risk, because the finance can expire. And then they run the risk that, you know, if their circumstances change, their financial or personal circumstances, or even if the financial industry changes, they may not be able to get finance again. And then that presents a problem for the client. So they really need to have, the contracts put together as one construction contract, put that through. And that's what a good broker will do. So I've seen brokers do it sort of the wrong way, and it's really affected the outcome of the clients. So yeah, definitely got to be put through as one contract, one loan.
So it sounds like a lot of the groundwork is really where the magic happens, and that sets people up for, I suppose, less risk down the track, Jerome.
Yeah, look, I mean, with these strategies that Lloyd's doing, where you're buying land and you're constructing, it is actually very key to actually forward plan. People have different circumstances, and if you don't actually get the right approval at the start, then you could have problems down the road, because approvals only last a certain time frame as well. And communicating that to a client and to the builder and to the buyer's agent is key as well. And forecasting if that's going to be an issue to get reapproved is another key thing.
I suppose looking at the current climate in Sydney, Melbourne, both, I guess, regional and metropolitan areas, off the back of what we've seen, you know, the Royal Commission finally finished last year, early in the year, the federal election sort of took place. And after that point in time, we did start to see the market find its feet again. What are the current challenges that you're finding which people are presented with to sort of navigate at the moment?
Look, I mean, one of the key things that's changed the complexion of how lending is assessed is living expenses. Banks are really drilling on that. They're going through bank statements, or at least it's compliant to look at the bank statements of the clients and understand their expenses. People don't understand how much they're spending these days, and I see it every day. They think they're spending $3,000 a month when they're actually spending $7,000-$8,000 a month. So it's actually good to understand, it's actually good for the client to understand how much you're spending. And if they've got plans to actually borrow, well, they better start to clean that up before they actually approach the bank.
So for people that are listening to this right now that are sort of, you know, they've got aspirations to buy property or to build a portfolio, but they've also acknowledged that they need to clean up their spending. Because as you've mentioned, this is a big thing that the banks are really honing in on at the moment. What advice can you give them, and how long a period will the banks be looking for at the moment to see a pretty clean slate?
Look, the best advice I give the client is, let's sit down and we'll do a budget together. Let's understand where your money's going. And then from there, we work backwards as to what you really need to start cutting back on. And normally it's a 3 to 4 month process where we journey, and every month I'm checking at their bank statements to see if they're actually progressing and improving. Unfortunately, we've got to take a hands-on commitment on and ensuring that the clients are actually changing their spending habits. Otherwise, we could be looking at it in 6 months' time and they're still spending the same amount and they can't borrow the funds that they need to borrow to buy that investment.
In my book, I've actually got a budget planner there, which is a budget planner that Joanna also uses. And I think that's very beneficial and helpful for people to be able to set their own budget to really get an understanding of how they spend their money. Because Jerome's right, people do spend a lot more than they actually think, or than what they actually maybe admit to doing. So one of my goals in the book is actually try to put that into perspective and try to help people actually understand that, to try to put them on the road to saving a little bit better.
It'd be interesting to know, when people are filling out their loan documents, if what the statistic is on accurate monthly spending.
It's never accurate, honestly. I mean, I actually have to go through that bank statement and spend 2 or 3 hours just actually going through all the transactions and just trying to recreate their spending habits. And a lot of times, 90% of the time, it's not accurate. People don't know what they're spending money on. But it's my job as the broker to actually educate them on that, and it's a good opportunity to put them back on the right road.
It's hard now when the banks come back and they look at their bank statement and they say, but you didn't tell us you're spending this, and what's this $3,000 for, and what's this $500 for?
Yeah, people would actually say, I'm spending $3,000, right, because they'll just state it, right? But then you look at just one credit card statement, they've got a few credit cards, but you look at one credit card statement and that month it's a debit of $7,000 already. So how does that work, you know? So it's educating a client in that space.
We're running out of time, guys. I think we could probably talk about this all day. There's so many important things to cover off on. Drone, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thanks for having me.
Lloyd, I suppose any closing comments in relation to this topic and the book?
We're going to cover off a lot more stuff in future episodes. So I'd just like to thank Jerome for coming in. And look, there's a whole chapter on money in the book, which really just... yeah, talks a lot about the mortgage brokers, the finance industry, talk about the changes that APRA did and my opinions on that and how I felt that that was. And yeah, just really helping people get ahead and save their money.
Very good. Thanks so much for your time, guys.
Thank you.
Cheers.
That concludes part one of our episode, Money, Money, Money. Jerome and Lloyd have shared some valuable experience in the role a mortgage broker plays in the Dream Team and in property investment. In part two, we'll be discussing with David Ross from Ross Accounting his role in the Dream Team as the accountant. David has a wealth of knowledge and experience in accounting and how best to structure a purchase for an investment, and to discuss the various options people have available to them, which they may not be aware of. Lloyd covers off on this topic in far greater detail in his book, Positively Geared. I strongly encourage you purchase a copy of Lloyd's book so that you too can achieve your path to financial freedom.